Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.7 in the Matsu Valley. RadioFreePalmer.org is our live streaming site. We're also on iTunes. Just search for us at Dog Works Radio. We're also over on social media on all of the sites. Just, again, search for Dog Works Radio. And did you know that we have an app now for the KVRF Radio Free Palmer Station? To search for it in the App Store, and you can pull it up and listen to all of our shows no matter where you're at. Calling in from California is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. I'm very excited that there's a Radio Free Palmer app now. It's, you know, everyone's got one.
Everybody has one, for sure, and I'm looking forward to having all of our shows show up over there, and you can listen to them 24 hours a day if you'd like.
Excellent.
So what has happened in your neck of the woods this week?
Well, you know, it's nearly the end of the year. It's, you know, it's getting towards the holidays, towards Christmas, you know, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, winter solstice, anything people celebrate. It's gotten to that point, and it seems to me this one really snuck up on me. It seems to me like just a very short time ago, it was, you know, the middle of the summer.
You know, I totally agree. It seems like yesterday we were talking about the Iditarod on our nightly coverage, and here we are dang near a year later, and it is coming up quick. You know, I have a question for you, Alex. Do you guys do anything special for the winter solstice down in your neck of the woods? You know, up here it's a big deal because it is the darkest day of the year.
I try to do something, a little something. It's not that big a deal here, and I think, frankly, it because we still have a lot more light than you guys do, it's, you know, the fact that it's shorter, it doesn't seem like it's as big a deal when you still have, you know, like 10 or 11 hours of light instead of, I guess, maybe 5 or 6.
Yeah, you know, up here it's 4:15 on Wednesday when we're recording this, and the sun is already set, and it's getting dark outside. All of the cars have their lights on, and it's in the full throes of winter. Just yesterday we were at minus 19 up in Willow, and we have about 8 to 10 inches of snow on the ground. So we're back on sleds. Everything is progressing nicely in terms of training. I see a lot of the kennels are out running their dogs with sleds now, and everybody's gearing up for the upcoming race season.
Which is fantastic, and I think that the temperatures are probably, it might be a little bit colder than you would want the humans, but I think it's really great for the dogs, and now you just need a lot more snow would probably help a lot.
Right, and you know, with these very cold temperatures way down in the negative temps, when it's that cold, it typically does not snow, so we need it to warm up quite a bit. We typically get a lot of our snow here in the Susitna Valley when it's about 20 degrees or so. You know, that 20 to 35 degree range is where we get most of our snow. We live relatively close to the river, and that is the same river that they run down on the Iditarod, running from Willow to Yetna Station and beyond. So we kind of get that river effect type snow where the cold air rushes up from the Cook Inlet and on into the valley here and produces its snow a little bit different than they do in Anchorage or on the peninsula or even in Valdez.
Right, and is the river frozen at this point? Can you run a little bit on the river?
Well, I have not been down to the river yet myself, but all of the lakes are frozen, so that's a pretty good indication that the rivers are passable. I'm sure that there's some open water spots, but usually the folks that groom those trails do a pretty good job because that is truly the highway of the north here in the winter. You know, lots of people use, you know, fishing boats and whatnot in the summer, but as soon as those rivers freeze up, it's a highway out there with lots of people moving goods and groceries and families and everything else up and down that river.
Yeah. You know, before we dive into today's topic, I just wanted to mention that since the last time we spoke, that new documentary, Sled Dogs, actually had its premiere at the Whistler Film Festival. And I feel like we've been talking about this movie a lot. And it was, I believe, tied for the winner in the documentary category at that festival. I know there are still a lot of people who are very upset with the movie and with the director and the point of view that the movie seems to have. I've read a number of things where people are talking about they want to make sure that this doesn't have the same kind of effect on dog sled sports as the movie Blackfish had on SeaWorld and the that situation. So that's still an ongoing thing. One of the reasons that I wanted to mention that specifically is that, as a lot of our listeners know, it's very expensive to have a kennel and to, you know, raise and run a team of dogs competitively. A lot of mushers rely on doing dog sled tours in the off season, and my understanding is that this movie really goes after several of the dog sled tour companies, and the director has said that one of her goals is to shut down the dog sled tour industry. And, you know, as we discussed several times, definitely if there are problems with the way certain operations are being run or the way that certain dogs are being treated, I think everyone wants to address that and make things better and, you know, establish real strong guidelines and best practices for how things should be run to make sure that the dogs are well taken care of. But it would be a disaster for a lot of mushers if the sled dog touring industry were to take a significant financial hit.
You know, I totally agree with you. And yes, I've been still seeing a lot of commentary back and forth on all of the social media sites, whether it be Twitter or Facebook or other internet sites. It doesn't seem to be dying down at all. You know, what's your take on that, Alex? What is sort of the shelf life of something like this? I know you were involved pretty heavily with these film festival type things. Since so few people have seen this movie so far, I guess it's only been shown once. I can imagine there was less than 100 people that saw the premiere there at the film festival. But very few people have seen it so far, but there's still a lot of reaction.
Yeah. You know, it's the sort of thing where, sometimes these movies come and they make a big splash and then they pretty much disappear without having any lasting impact. When the movie starts winning awards, people start paying more attention to it. I believe it's going to have its TV. It's going to be shown on TV in Canada, so it should get a lot more people should be able to see it then. I would imagine it would play a bunch of other film festivals. It's really hard to know, and again, I kind of hate to talk about it without seeing it, but it really seems more and more to be the case that the director believes that any way of treating dogs other than having them inside the house in your living room is cruel. And, you know, I just fundamentally disagree with that, as I think most of our listeners and most people I know who work with dogs, especially, you know, dogs who pull sleds and dogs who are up in the north.
Right. And you know what I found interesting, Alex, and I know we don't want to go too deep into this topic today because we do have something else to talk about. But as you know, I returned to school in my mid-40s to earn another degree. I have no idea why, but that's beside the point. But I am involved with a group of students that are in an outdoor leadership program at the University of Anchorage, or University of Alaska at Anchorage. And most of these kids, you know, the 18 to 24 year range, are heavily involved with the outdoors, whether it be skiing, snow machining, camping, whatever. And a lot of these kids from our program have been up to my kennel and have gone for rides and see how we operate. But throughout the semester, since this news broke of this movie, I've asked all of these guys and gals what their opinion is of mushing, and do they know anything about this documentary? And every one of them had a positive take on mushing, and absolutely none of them have, it's not even on their radar. They aren't even, you know, necessarily concerned about this. So I think, I think that the mushing community obviously has a big take in this, but I don't necessarily think the general public does, at least from that small population of maybe 50 students or so who I've talked to over the semester. They don't even know and or care that this documentary is even out.
Right. And maybe, you know, maybe we're making too big a deal out of this by talking about it a lot. But just to sort of piggyback on something you said, everyone I know who has ever been to a racing kennel or seen these dogs up close or gone for a ride with sled dogs has just an overwhelmingly positive opinion of the entire experience and the entire sport. So it makes me wonder if maybe what's happening is a lot of people who have never been around sled dogs or never really been anywhere where there are mushers and where there are people who have their own kennels and are racing dogs, maybe this is something that is just scaring a lot of people who, you know, live in the cities or the suburbs and all they know about dogs as house pets.
Right. So I have a question for you in regards to this. Have you ever changed your opinion on something based on a documentary? And I'm thinking about documentaries like the Michael Moore films. Have you gone out and deliberately changed the way that you act or interact because of a documentary and the way that particular topic is portrayed on that type of medium?
I'm sure that I have. There's a documentary a while ago called Who Killed the Electric Car, and I had my impression of electric cars back then, and this is probably going back 10 or 12 years, was that they just weren't practical, and that's why they disappeared. And then after watching that movie, I thought, well, wait, these are really things that could be very useful in certain circumstances. And I think a lot of people had that opinion, and a few years after that movie came out, we started seeing a new generation of electric cars.
Right. And, you know, I'm thinking of all of the documentaries out there about GMOs and farming practices and, you know, all those sorts of in-your-face type documentaries that are out there. I just wonder how many people, you know, immediately switch their lifestyle or their very strong opinions one way or the other based on a documentary that they see. Because the way I see this is, unless it's somebody like Morgan Spurlock or Michael Moore or somebody like that, we don't know who these people are. You know, they're just documentary filmmakers. Then they may have an agenda. They may have a message to promote, but they're relatively nobodies. Don't you agree?
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot of this in documentary filmmaking. There's a lot of preaching to the choir, and there's a lot of people trying to figure out how they can get something to really break out and have a larger influence, especially if it's something, you know, if it's an issue-based documentary. I think that there were some documentary films made in gosh, I want to say like the 60s or 70s, about psychiatric hospitals and showing some of the way patients were mistreated there. And I think those had a real impact in terms of changing the way that industry worked. So that might be an example. But I do get your point that there's a lot of times people just go to documentaries that seem to reflect what they already think.
Right.
And then they come out of the documentary having had their thinking reinforced.
Well, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out over the next couple of months, in particular if that that documentary is aired a little bit more widely than it already has been. It's going to be interesting to see how the race season develops. You know, the mid-distance races have yet to take place, not only in Alaska but everywhere else. It's going to be interesting to see how the Iditarod plays out. Is there going to be protesters and that sort of thing? I highly doubt it, but I guess we'll have to see how the next 3 or 4 months plays out in regards to this, because I don't think that this issue is going to go away overnight, and I think that a lot of mushers are sort of digging their heels in and ready to put up a fight if they have to.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, having people expose the other side as well, and having mushers speak out against this and maybe have people look at best practices and guidelines for how dogs should be treated and maybe revise some of those, that seems to be a really good thing to me, because that will get out the message that dog care is really important and the way these dogs are treated is something that is, you know, foremost in the minds of everyone who does this.
Well, you know, we're being proactive up here. I know just our kennel alone, we called up the Animal Control Board just this morning and made sure that our license and we're in compliance and, you know, when we need to reapply and about inspections and all that. And I know a lot of other local mushing kennels have done the same thing. They've made sure to take proactive steps to make sure that at least from a government standpoint or a regulatory standpoint, everybody is on the up and up and everybody's licensed the way they should be and inspected. And I think that's one thing that we can do on a positive side is to make sure that we police each other and our kennels are looking the way that they should look and be as clean and as functional as possible.
Right, and that is so important because, you know, anyone can forget and miss a deadline and not renew something, and under ordinary circumstances, that's not a big deal. You take care of it, and sometimes if you're late, you pay a late fee or a little fine or something like that. But in this environment, anything that is not up to snuff, that's not following all the rules, I think could be misinterpreted by critics and could be shown as a sign of that the dogs aren't being properly thought of or properly looked after.
All right, Alex, we have about 8 minutes left in our show today, and I know we have to keep our shows at the 30-minute mark because we're here in the studio and they have the commercials at the top and the bottom of the hour. So let's jump into this topic relatively quickly. You wanted to talk a little bit about how to get a race started. What is your thoughts? What are your thoughts?
So I know that you've put a lot of thought into this, and I am because every year we see there's a lot of races that, you know, have been going on for a long time, but every year there's one or two new races that usually mid-distance races that come up. And I'm just wondering what the process is to start and launch a new race.
Well, first and foremost, in particular in Alaska, the one thing that you want to make sure that you have in your race plan is it or is it not going to be a qualifier for the Iditarod? Typically, that takes a year under your belt before it is approved by the Iditarod Trail Committee. I know several races in the recent past have been granted this exception, I know the Willow 300 was granted this exception, and I know the race up in Fairbanks, the newer race put on by Ken Anderson, I believe it's called the Tolvana 300 or something like that. So, yes, making sure you have all your ducks in the row to get the race approved to be a qualifier is a key step. But, you know, what we found when we were doing our research, and we wanted to do a race over Hatcher's Pass, which is a pretty difficult area to develop a race in, mainly because of avalanches. And that's one of the main reasons why we didn't move forward with it. One of the main things that we had a struggle with was making sure that we had all of the permits in place, and that sort of thing with the rangers or the parks department or whoever you're using it with. Because remember, up here in Alaska, once it becomes winter, a lot of those folks sort of dissipate. They aren't as active in their offices as they are in the summertime. So they were tough to get in touch with. Another big component, of course, is insurance. There is a thing out there called event insurance. It's typically used for, the 5Ks that you see on the weekends for the Heart Association and that sort of thing. It's not a huge expense for one day for a one weekend race. I think it was about $350 or so to put on a race. Of course, I think the biggest issue in putting on the race is having the volunteer support. And as well as I do with Iditarod and all of these other races, that they're constantly looking for volunteers. You often find that the race fills up very quickly, but the volunteer positions are struggling to be filled, so that it becomes a pretty important thing that you need to work on. And another thing up here in Alaska in particular is the calendar. We only have, 9 weekends or so of racing here in Alaska, usually starting somewhere the first week of January and ending the week before Iditarod. And almost all of those weekends are currently taken up by other races, whether it be the Copper Basin or the Cusco 300 or the Kinnick 200 or the Northern Lights or whatever. And it's difficult to start another race without stepping on that already established race's toes. So you have to find a date either before the race season, which is difficult because of the lack of snow, or after Iditarod, where snow may not be an issue, but interest and or availability of teams to come about may be an issue, because of course they've ran all season, they're finishing up on Iditarod, the season is almost over, they're ready to hang up the harnesses, so to speak, so participation can get a little difficult. So that's sort of my take off of one hand. What other questions do you have?
When you're looking at how to figure out where the race is going to go, how do you do that? Do you have to go on a snow machine and chart it out? And then are there issues with making sure that you have you have the right mixture of public land and permission to go on private land if you go on any private land? Is that part of the planning as well?
Yes. For example, we're doing an expedition with those same students I was mentioning earlier at UAA, where we're going to take a group of students from Willow up to Tal Vista, then down to Eagle Song, and then back through the Nancy Lake area and back to Willow. So sort of a triangular route of about 190 miles in mid-March. And one of the things that we did is we flew the route, in early to mid-October, we flew the route by plane, and we checked it out and GPSed it and that sort of thing, making sure that we had a good understanding of the route that we were going to use. But we did it well in advance, way before we were able to get out there on snow machines and or dog sleds.
And is there, when you're planning on a race, is there some sort of formula that you use to try to figure out how much you want elevation gain or how much you want to be on or near rivers, or does it just entirely depend on where you are?
I think it would. It depends on where you are. As I was mentioning, that race through the Hatcher Pass area, that's an extreme amount of elevation gain. I'm sure you've taken that route on your visits to Alaska, driving from Willow over to Palmer. It's a very scenic drive in the summertime, but it goes up about 3,000 feet or so in elevation from Willow and then over the pass and into Palmer. So that was one of the questions that we had to get answered was that capable through the switchbacks and being able to come up and down and around. But if you notice, Alex, a lot of the races that go on here in the Mattsu Valley, a lot of them do use the rivers. When you think about the Willow 300, as we mentioned earlier, and the Connect 200, those are using the established Iditarod Trail that is very well-known and well-used by most mushers in the community.
And one other thing that I've always been curious about, when you are trying to establish a new race, I know we always talk about how important sponsorship is and how there is a lot of different people, both on the musher side and on the corporate race side, competing to get sponsors to help support their event or their, you know, attempt to run the event. Is that something that you think about in the planning, or is that something that comes later when the race is starting to come together?
Well, I think that corporate sponsors are a big part of any race. I don't think that you would have a purse, per se, if you did not have sponsors on board. And you know what I think is a great example of this is the Willow Junior 100, which is pretty much ran in our backyard on the Hessler-Norris Trail System. And it's put on by a group of folks, including Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Vern Halter. What they do there is they do not charge the kids, and I believe you're able to run this race from 12 to 17 years old, is they do not charge the kids an entry, and all of the prizes are donated. And they give every kid a 5-gallon bucket, you know, the ones you get at the Home Depot, the orange ones. And each place gets certain items. You know, the first place may get a sled, the second place may get a parka or a sleeping bag, and you sort of work your way down. But all of the kids are getting stuff, whether it's gift cards from the local vendors or, you know, socks that were donated by the local sporting goods store or whatever. And I think that's a great example of not only a very well put on race, but a great example of community support of a race.
Yeah, that sounds really wonderful.
And I know Junior Iditarod does something very similar. And what they have, which is different than the adult races, is they offer sponsorships to the kids. I think it's the first 5 places of Junior Iditarod receives a scholarship of varying amounts depending on the placement that the kids can use at any school in Alaska, whether it be UAA or UAF or one of the tech schools, you know, aircraft mechanics or whatever. And there's been several Junior Iditarod champions that have won these sponsorships several years, and they're pretty much going to school just for winning these mushing events, which I think is a great way to harness the spirit of Iditarod as well as making sure that our kids have viable futures.
Yeah, that's just fantastic. I always love hearing about things like that involving kids and involving, you know, some sort of scholarship, because, as you said, that's really where the future is.
Right. So, Alex, we are out of time here. I know it went quick. Do you have any idea for a topic next time? And I believe next time will be the week in between Christmas and New Year's.
I don't off the top of my head, but I'm sure that we will come up with something. And if any of our listeners have ideas or things that they want to hear about, please tweet to us, hit us up on Facebook and other social media, and we'd we'd love to hear what you guys are interested in.
Excellent.
Always.
Well, Alex, have a good holiday. We will talk afterwards. And until then, I hope all of our listeners have a great holiday season. And get ready, because the mushing season is about to kick off.
Excellent. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you. On behalf of my co-host, Alex Stein, this is Robert Forto. We will see you guys next time. Goodbye.